faced her brother. Tell me what the cure is. He studied her but said nothing. Are you willing to risk our lives to keep your secrets? She paused. Explain it and then we'll leave. It was a bluff, but she needed to know what the cure was. Andrew swallowed, then spoke quietly. It's something new, a nanotech device. Peyton knew very little about nanomedicine. It was a growing field with incredible potential. Doctors were experimenting with nanorobots to do a number of things. Treating cancer, delivering drugs to hard-to-reach parts of the body, and identifying pathogens. It was conceivable that it could be used to neutralize a virus or bacteria. Her brother confirmed her theory with his next words. The nanorobots find and inactivate the virus. They're also programmed to do limited tissue repair in critical areas, reducing mortality. His tone changed, grew bitter. If more of the world's governments had complied, the death rate would be a fraction of what it is. Peyton studied him. What else does it do? Andrew said nothing. That's what this is about, isn't it? The pandemic was for this moment. The nanorobots you're distributing within the cure, that's the looking glass. He shook his head. No, only a part. One of three, Peyton whispered, almost to herself. Yes, the cure is rapture. How does it work? Another explosion rocked the building, this one stronger. Those were missiles from the sea. They're firing on the island. Lynn grabbed her daughter by the arm. Peyton, it's time. She pulled away. She wouldn't leave. She couldn't. Everything she'd gone through in the past 2 weeks had been for this exact moment. It all led here, to this turning point. Peyton had finally realized the entire truth. Desmond had discovered what rapture was. He had called her to warn her. And though he didn't know then why he was warning her, it was clear to her now. He had known that Yuri and Connor would try to capture her, to use her as leverage. She alone connected all the critical players who could stop the pandemic. Lynn, Desmond, William, and Andrew. She alone could be used to control all of them. They're going to use rapture for some sort of alteration, aren't they? They're going to change human biology. Andrew and Lynn both stared at Peyton in disbelief, or perhaps with admiration, that she had put it together so quickly. Andrew gazed down at the manufacturing floor as he spoke. The nanorobots are designed to take additional instructions after they neutralize the virus. Their size limits their memory capacity. Peyton marveled at the plan. Research was already ongoing that used nanorobots to insert genes into a host, altering its genome. The nanoparticles could cross the blood-brain barrier, allowing them to alter pathways in the brain and the biochemical balance. That must be what happened to Desmond. He used Rapture Therapeutics' core rapture device, the nanorobots, to block his memories. Rapture, the nanorobots, would give the Sishium an unimaginable control over the human race, the power to alter every person at a cellular level. All the Sishium had to do was send additional instructions to their nanorobots after the virus was eliminated. Which meant that was the key to stopping them, preventing the Rapture nanorobots from getting further instructions. That would take away the Sishium's power. She looked at her brother a long moment. They had radicalized him. Peyton wasn't sure if she could make him see the truth, but she had to try. Andrew, think about what they've done. How many people the Sishium has killed. If they control Rapture, imagine what they'll do. He shook his head. You don't understand. I do. I've seen it. The stacks of dead bodies. Andrew, Dad's alive! The words shocked him. Impossible. To Peyton's surprise, her mother spoke up. It's true, Andrew. Yuri tried to kill him, but he survived. He stepped back, away from them, wincing as he tried to come to grips with the information. Peyton sensed that this was the moment to make a move. Andrew, can you disable the remote access? Prevent the Rapture nanorobots from taking additional instructions? Andrew said nothing, but Peyton still knew him well enough to read him. She could see that she was right. He could stop this. Do it, please. It's the only way to stop them. I'm not leaving until you do. His eyes flashed to her. I'll have you dragged out of here. Another explosion rocked the building. All four of them crouched as more ceiling tiles rained down. You'll have to drag me out too, Charlotte said. Lynn walked over and stood next to Peyton and Charlotte, silently showing her willingness to stay as well. Listen to what we're saying, Peyton said. They've brainwashed you, Andrew. We're telling you the truth. Please do it. Even if you drag me out of here, I'll never forgive you if you don't stop them right now. Andrew stared at Peyton, then Charlotte, then his mother, and finally out at the factory floor. Trust us, Peyton said. Nobody cares about you more than the three of us. Believe what we're telling you. She waited a moment. I'm willing to die to try to stop the Sishium. They've killed people I cared about. Tried to kill Dad. They took you from me, Andrew. This isn't who you are. I don't care what the looking glass is, Charlotte added. This world isn't perfect, and that makes it worth having. Just like you. Another explosion shook the building, much closer this time, with far greater force. The glass walls overlooking the massive manufacturing machines exploded outward, raining glass down. A tall cabinet overturned, barely missing Charlotte. Andrew was at her side in an instant, pulling her away. You okay? She nodded. Charlotte gripped Andrew's shoulders. Please, she pulled him closer to her. Please, Andrew. Like a wall crumbling, his hard expression dissolved. He smiled a remorseful yet kind smile. Peyton saw then the older brother she had grown up with, the brother who had helped take care of her in the years after their father was gone. Slowly he nodded. Okay. He moved to a raised table with a computer terminal. I can disable the remote access to the Rapture nanorobots from here and remove the backup program from the Rook service. He twisted the hand portion of his prosthetic and removed it. He stuck it in a pocket, then took out another attachment that was affixed to his belt. It resembled a hand, but with yellow-white plastic fingers that barely hid the wires below. He twisted it onto the end of his prosthetic forearm. Peyton watched in wonder as the fingers twitched. The stump must have given tiny impulses to the prosthetic, which electronically controlled the hand and fingers. For the first time in her life, Peyton saw her brother use a real left hand. She wondered if the Sishium had leveraged this gift to gain control over him. She couldn't imagine what he had been through, or what his road back would be like. He was a classic victim of Stockholm Syndrome, when captives come to trust, and in some cases join their captors. Another series of explosions rocked the building. The lights flickered, and everyone froze. If the power went out, it was over. And if the building was hit, they'd be trapped down here, crushed. Keep working, Peyton said. I'm going above to radio to them. Tell them not to hit the building. I'll go with you, Lynn said. If they are Sishium troops, I'll deal with them. All eyes turned to Charlotte. She moved to stand beside Andrew. I'm not going anywhere. Chapter 127 The lights flickered in the stairwell as Peyton pounded up the stairs. The elevators were either broken or had been shut down. Her mother lagged behind her. The woman had always been in excellent health, but she was in her late 70s. Another explosion rattled the metal staircase, nearly throwing Peyton off her feet. Lynn grabbed the handrail and braced herself on the wall. Go on, darling. I'm right behind you. No, you're not. We're staying together, Mom. She wrapped her arm around the lithe woman, and they climbed the stairs together, the bombs exploding outside as they marched. At the ground floor landing, Peyton paused when she saw a thin film of smoke issuing forth from the crack beneath the door. She placed her hand on the door, felt warmth, then pulled the bottom of her shirt around her hand and lightly touched the handle. It was too hot for her to touch. We're trapped. Connor crouched over his brother's limp body. Desmond's face was bloodied and bruised. He took his brother in his arms and hugged him tight, rocking. "Diz," he whispered. Right after Desmond had been knocked out, the air raids had struck the building. It sounded as though a large portion of it had collapsed, and fire was consuming the rest. The flames were closing in, marching down the hallway toward them. The soldiers had left. Rats fleeing a sinking ship, or more precisely, a burning island. Connor had been too young to remember the fire that had permanently scarred him, but the burns had left him terrified of fire. He didn't even like eating in restaurants with a fireplace. Wouldn't set foot inside a home with one. The sight of a large open flame paralyzed him. He watched the blaze clawing away at the building, consuming more of it each second. He was alone now, with his brother, in much the same way their lives had started, in the face of an unstoppable fire. 33 years ago, it had been Connor who had lain helplessly as the fire advanced. Desmond hadn't saved him. There was something fitting about leaving him, completing the cycle. But Connor was ashamed of the thought. Those dark impulses were exactly the thing Desmond had tried to help him control. Tried and failed. He was what he was. The fire was closer now. Connor felt himself start to shiver, as if he were naked in the Arctic. The force rattling his body, however, was not cold, but fear, an overwhelming, petrifying force. He heard footsteps behind him, but Connor barely turned his head. Yuri squatted down in front of him. His face was bloody, one eye swollen shut. He examined Connor, searching for a wound, confusion clouding his face when he found none. His voice was hoarse, perhaps from the smoke inhalation. "What's happened?" "I can't," Connor whispered. Yuri glanced at the flames closing on them, seemed to understand. "You must, Connor. Every man faces his demons. Yours is here. Will you cower and let it best you? Now is your chance. Show me what you really are." Chapter 128. On the landing of the smoke-filled stairwell, in the glow of the emergency lights, Peyton ripped her clothes off. First the body armor, then the breathable mesh Kevlar undershirt. She knelt over the garments, clad only in her bra and khaki pants, and drew the knife from a sheath on her belt. She cut two long strips of mesh from the short-sleeved shirt, wrapped one around her mouth, and handed the other to her mother. The older woman followed Peyton's lead. Peyton pulled the shirt back on, and wrapped the body armor around her left arm, prepping it to use as an insulated shield against the fire. She made sure her comm unit was still affixed. She crouched down and turned her back to her mother. "Climb on!" "Honey!" "Mom, do it! We don't have time to argue!" Lynn Shaw exhaled as she stepped closer to her youngest daughter. Her voice seemed to slip deeper into her British accent as she muttered, "Well, there's no need to be rude." With her mother's arms around her neck, Peyton rose, hit the door handle with her armor-wrapped hand, and rushed into the hall. The smoke was thick, but the flames were mostly confined to studs in the walls and the furniture burning in the offices. She turned a corner and saw the lobby. The wooden reception desk blazed like a bonfire. The wind rushed in, feeding the fire endless amounts of the oxygen it needed to burn. Waves of heat pushed deeper into the structure, past Peyton, like the tide lapping at a beach. But beyond the desk, beyond the shattered glass windows, the darkness of night loomed. Freedom. She could make it. Peyton pressed on, putting one foot in front of the other. Her lungs burned. Her head swam. She felt a new admiration for Desmond. Days ago, he had carried her father out of a burning building at Arask 7. Now it was Peyton's turn, and she pushed with every ounce of energy in her body. Her legs didn't give out until she crossed the threshold of the front doors. She felt herself collapse then, but she didn't hit the ground. Her mother wrapped her arms around her and dragged her from the blaze. Through watering eyes, she saw dark hair streaked with gray hanging down in front of her, a curtain across her face. It was drawn back, and Peyton saw her mother staring down, tears in her eyes. She ripped the mesh Kevlar from Peyton's mouth, turned her head, and held her ear to Peyton's mouth. Lynn let out a cry of joy when she realized her daughter was breathing. She pulled her closer into her lap. "It's going to be okay, honey." Slowly, Peyton's senses focused. Automatic gunfire rang out in the distance. "They're fighting for the harbor. The Marines must have landed." Engines roared. High-caliber artillery guns pounded. Overhead, she saw more missile strikes. A few exploded in the air, but many found their targets, churning earth and trees and bodies in massive eruptions of fire and smoke. The entire island seemed to be erupting. She brought a shaking hand to her collarbone, activated her comm, and spoke with a scratchy, strained voice. Overwatch. Artemis, cease fire at my location. We have friendlies in the adjacent building. Confirm. Artemis, Overwatch confirmed, ceasing airstrikes at your location. A second later, the CIC operator opened the comm line again. Artemis, Overwatch. Be advised there are hostiles inbound tier 20. Estimate a force of 12 heavily armed. Reinforcements are 2 clicks out. Advise you take cover or retreat. Chapter 129. In her peripheral vision, Peyton saw the soldiers closing on them. Carefully, Lin Shaw placed Peyton's head on the ground and stood tall, her posture rigid, facing the oncoming troops like a proud mother ready to defend her child with her own life. Peyton desperately wanted to stand with her, but she couldn't. She didn't have the strength. Every breath burned. The soldiers halted their sprint when they saw Lin. The nearly 80-year-old woman's voice was strong as it called into the smoke-filled night. Major, we have friendlies in this building. They are mission critical to our cause. Rescue them. Do it now. The man hesitated, then touched his collarbone. Dr. Pachenko, Major Reeves. The man paused, listening. Peyton was shocked. Yuri Pachenko is here. The man had taken so much from her. Her hatred boiled as the mercenary activated his calm again. Dr. Pachenko? Lin took a step toward him. Send your men in, Major. Do it now or there will be consequences. Reeves motioned for 4 of his men to enter the building. To the soldiers entering, Lin said, Basement level 4. A man and a woman. They'll be together. Major Reeves scowled at Lin. My last orders were to secure the Rapture Control Program. The situation has changed, Major, and so have your orders. Dr. Pachenko is no longer in charge here. I am. Tell your men at the harbor and elsewhere to stand down. Reeves was shocked. Ma'am? Those are your orders. We face an overwhelming force. The battle here can't be won. We must surrender for the greater good. We are prepared for this contingency, I assure you, Major. The soldier nodded slowly, activated his comm, and ordered a full surrender. Peyton sat up, seeing her mother with a whole new appreciation. She did it. This was an entirely new side of the mild-mannered woman who had raised her. Peyton activated her own comm. Overwatch, Artemis. Be advised, hostiles have been ordered to stand down. The gunfire in the distance stopped. Seconds later, so did the missile fire coming in from the sea. For a moment, the dense island jungle was quiet. The towering palm trees swayed in the wind, bristling with each gust. The fire blazing behind her crackled. Here and there, pieces of the building collapsed. With each passing second, Peyton was able to catch her breath. Artemis, Overwatch. Ceasefire confirmed. Commencing search and rescue operations. First wave of helos inbound. ETA 30 minutes. Copy, Overwatch. Ground teams are en route to your location. Copy that. Thank you. Peyton sat up and stared at the building. Andrew was in there, trapped beyond the fire. In the years after she was told he'd died in a fire, she dreamt about it 1,000 times. Nightmares, with Andrew trapped and her unable to help, but this time it was real. The building was collapsing in on itself. She lay on her back again. She couldn't bear to watch. She wanted to go back in the building, but she was too weak. She activated her comm again. Dad? Desmond? Avery? She'd forgotten their call signs, but it didn't matter now. She just wanted to hear their voices. But no one responded. She called again. And a third time, nothing. She closed her eyes, willing it not to be true. Desmond, her father, Andrew. In the past 4 days, all three had been returned to her. Now they might be taken away again. And somewhere deep inside her, she knew she would never recover this time. Chapter 130. It had been 10 minutes since the soldiers entered the burning lab complex. Peyton was on her feet now, able to breathe better, but not 100%. She peered into the flames, looking for any signs of figures emerging. The pulsing heat warmed her face and body. A breeze pushed the blaze back every few seconds. A gruff voice came over Peyton's comm.
Artemis, Zulu leader. We've got a live one. Request medical assistance. We're at the admin building.
Major Reeves had been coordinating his troops' surrender, which was finally complete. Peyton interrupted a string of orders he was calling out. Can one of your men take me to the admin building? Reeves glanced at Lynn, who nodded. He instructed one of his soldiers to accompany Peyton, and they set off down a stone path, walking as quickly as she could manage. Her lungs still ached, but hope drove her on. The administrative building was a charred ruin. The entire top two floors had burned down. Trails of smoke rose from orange embers crackling in the night. A half dozen of the camo-clad special forces, members of Zulu and Bravo teams, waded through the wreckage, turning the blackened pieces with the barrels of their rifles searching. Ahead, a Navy SEAL motioned for Peyton to come quickly. She swallowed, dreading what she would see. She repeated the words over the comm in her mind. We've got a live one. Alive, but in what condition? And who? She knew who she wanted it to be. In the moment, she was completely honest with herself. She wanted to see Desmond's face. She wanted to leave the island with him more than anything in the world. In the boxer's mess, he had said the things he needed to say. But she hadn't. She knew that had been a mistake. One she might live to regret. 20 feet away, beyond the Navy SEAL, lay a burned-out crater, nearly smooth in the center. A ring of bodies circled it. In hot zones around the world, Peyton had seen pathogens rip through a population, leaving death behind. This was an altogether different form of carnage. Men lay in pieces. Dead eyes stared up at her, or out into the forest. Severed limbs lay alone, remnants of the slaughter strewn about without care or mercy. Rivulets of blood flowed into the crater like the veins on the back of a dark earthen monster. As Peyton descended into the hole, steam rose from it, as if the spirits of the lives lost were drifting toward the yellow moon above. The Navy SEAL told her that he was a corpsman. He had stopped the bleeding, but the patient needed an infusion quickly. A medevac was inbound with blood, but it would be close. The boxer had a capable operating room. Unfortunately, it would be almost an hour before the patient reached the table. As the SEAL shifted to the side, Peyton held her breath. Avery lay on the ground, dirt plastered across her pale face and in her blonde hair. Her breathing was shallow. Peyton knelt at her side. A 6-inch gash ran across her abdomen. The corpsman had done a good job. The wound was packed tight. Splinters from shattered trees dotted her body. Avery murmured a phrase Peyton couldn't make out. The corpsman had loaded her up with a painkiller. That was good. There wasn't much else Peyton could do. In truth, the Navy medical officer was better trained to treat battlefield injuries than Peyton was. There was only one thing she could give the young woman. And for that reason, she sat silently, waiting. Avery cracked her eyes, mumbled again. Peyton gripped her hand. You're going to be okay, Avery. Medevac is on the way. Surgeons are already prepped and waiting on you. An amused grin formed on Avery's lips. You taking care of me now? Peyton smiled back at her. Yeah, I am. You know how I am about that. About my people. Then I know I'm going to make it. You're a real pain in the ass. Peyton laughed, a nervous, cathartic laugh, like a pressure valve releasing the tension from her body. Look who's talking, she shot back. More seriously, Peyton asked, did you get it? Avery nodded. Yeah, we got it. We. The word filled Peyton with hope. Avery's smile faded. What did you find in the labs? Peyton considered what to say. Nothing that'll be a problem. A soldier searching the building called out, Got another one! Instinctively, Peyton's head snapped around, seeking out the caller. She desperately wanted to rush over, but she returned her focus to Avery. The blonde woman released Peyton's hand. Go. That's one of our people. They need you too. I'll see you on the boxer, Avery. Peyton stumbled over the bombed-out ground, weaving around bodies and into the ruined building. Up a stairwell littered with debris, she found soldiers pulling wreckage away, revealing more of a body. It was limp. The torso came into view. The chest was caved in, not breathing. The moment Peyton saw her father's face, she closed her eyes. Tears flowed. Her legs gave way. She sank to her knees, letting them dig into the ash-covered floor. Her eyes settled on a half-burned picture frame. The picture was of a short, white-haired man with a cold, blank expression. He matched Desmond and her father's description of Yuri Pachinko. And Peyton had no doubt that was exactly who it was. This was Yuri's office. He killed my father. Her entire life, she had blamed fate and bad luck for the loss of her father. Now she had a name to put with the rage that consumed her, Yuri Pachinko. He had taken her father from her. She would make him pay. Yuri had wanted to change the world, and he had certainly succeeded in changing her. She would be the end of him, and the burned remains of the building, with her father lying dead 10 feet away, she swore it. Another soldier's voice called into the night, "Got another one!" Chapter 131 Elliot held his wife's head in his lap. The RV sitting in an alley off Marietta Street was warm from the small heaters, and the people crammed inside. Ryan was with them, as well as Sam and Adam, and a dozen of Elliot's neighbors and their loved ones. At the table, a mother was reading Charlotte's Web to 4 children packed in around her. The kids were leaning in, gazing at the pictures. 2 teenagers were stretched out on opposite ends of a couch, playing games on tablets, headphones in their ears. 3 adult couples snacked on protein bars and sipped bottled water while they tuned a handheld radio, searching for any signal on the AM band. The chorus of coughing never ceased. The X1 Mandera virus was ravaging all of them, some to a greater degree than others. It was only a matter of time before their bodies began surrendering to the pathogen. Elliot feared Rose would be the first casualty. A series of beeps sounded from the radio, the prelude to an emergency message. One of Elliot's neighbors tuned the dial. The static cleared, and the beeps came into focus, then stopped. Every eye turned to the radio. Even the teenagers jerked their earbuds out and sat up. A man's voice spoke slowly, in the solemn, deliberate tone of someone reading a statement. "My fellow Americans, wherever you are, whatever you're doing, please stop and hear this message. It may save your life or the lives of your loved ones. My name is James Marshall. Many of you know me as the Speaker of the House. 2 days ago, I was sworn in as President of the United States. I'm speaking to you now because we face a threat unlike any in the history of our great nation. First, know that I bring you good news. The X1 Mandera pandemic that has ravaged our great nation and others around the world will soon come to an end. The United States, working with scientists in the international community, has developed a viable cure for the virus. The treatment also functions as a vaccine for anyone not infected." Inside the RV, cheers went up. Some stared in disbelief. Elliot was instantly suspicious. "However, the best news I bring you today is that the cure we've developed is available right now in your city. As we speak, the combined BioShield forces have established treatment checkpoints throughout your cordon zone. It's important that you receive the X1 Mandera cure as soon as possible, but I also urge you to remain calm and proceed in an orderly fashion. Those committing acts of violence and disorder will be sent to the back of the line. There will be a zero-tolerance policy for rioters and anyone cutting in line or preventing others from getting the cure. This broadcast will now switch to a local announcement that will list the X1 Mandera treatment centers in your area. That announcement will repeat. I wish you good luck, wherever you are. May God bless you and your family, and may God bless the United States of America." The RV erupted in shouting and questions. One of the neighbors pounded an empty can of beans on the counter, like a gavel in a courtroom, demanding silence. The voice on the radio was already reading the locations in the Atlanta cordon. At the words, "Centennial Olympic Park," everyone began pulling on their overcoats and moving toward the RV's door. Ryan was at Elliot's side within seconds. "What do you think?" Elliot didn't say what he thought, that something was very wrong. Treatments for novel pathogens weren't created overnight or in a week. They certainly weren't mass-produced that fast, with doses in the hundreds of millions and distributed all over the country. On the other hand, his wife was dying. The love of his life would be gone in hours. What do I have to lose? I think we need to hurry, he said. He lifted Rose up and staggered out of the RV, into the cold late afternoon. Ryan carried the wheelchair out, unfolded it, and held it while Elliot sat Rose down. Sam was at Elliot's side, holding Adam, whose fever had been running high. Ryan took the boy into his arms and followed closely behind Elliot. They exited the alley and jogged down Marietta Street. The chill in the wind was merciless on Elliot's face. An endless flow of people poured out of buildings and adjoining streets. Soon the crowd was as thick as a Christmas Day parade, marching, pushing toward the tents that loomed in Centennial Park. Metal fencing funneled everyone to canopies, where soldiers stood watch beside individuals wearing flak jackets with the letters FEMA printed on them. When Elliot reached a FEMA official, she took one look at Rose, said, "Line one," and handed him a red card. The soldiers motioned him onward. There were five lines, as it turned out, prioritized based on need. Line one was for the most critical patients. It was also the only line moving. Elliot glanced back at Ryan, who was still holding Adam. Ryan simply nodded, urging his parents to go on ahead. Another FEMA staffer directed the people in line one to cubicles where medical staff were holding jet injectors. Vials were spread out beside them, as well as silver oblong objects, CO2 cartridges. Elliot tried to get a look at any labeling on the vials or injector, but there wasn't any. He wondered if he would ever know the full truth of how this life-saving cure, the cure that had just been injected into his wife, had arrived in the nick of time. For some reason, he thought of Peyton. He hoped she was safe. On the other side of the treatment cubicle, another FEMA staffer was directing them out of the park. Someone asked, "What do we do now?" "Stay warm and keep hydrated. Now move on, make room for the people behind you." Back at the RV, Elliot again curled into the bed with Rose. He had something he didn't have an hour ago. Hope. For the first time in 2 days, he fell asleep. Chapter 132. Peyton was still numb from seeing her father's dead body, yet she walked across the charred ruins of the building toward the body the soldiers were pulling from the wreckage. She stopped when she saw the wig with wavy brown hair. The wig Desmond had worn into the building. It was half burned away and matted with blood. A hulking Navy SEAL pulled a wooden beam off the body. It didn't move. It was limp. The left arm severed. The legs burned. Dead. With no hope of coming back. Peyton's hands began to shake. She clasped them together and continued to march forward. The Sishium security operatives conducting the search parted when she reached them. She exhaled. "It's not him." Peyton studied the face closer. He wasn't one of the SEALs or Force Recon members who had been part of their team. "It's not one of ours." Another tear, this one of joy, rolled down her face. She walked away from the building then, back to Avery, and held the woman's hand while they waited for the medevac. The slender woman drifted in and out of consciousness while Peyton monitored her pulse. A Sishium security contractor tentatively made his way over to them. "They finished the search," he said. "We didn't find any non-Sishium personnel." Peyton nodded. "Thank you for telling me." The man unclipped his radio and earpiece and handed them to Peyton. "Your mother's on the comm." The moment she slipped the earpiece in, Peyton heard her mother's voice giving orders rapid fire to the soldiers around her.
"Mom? Peyton, your brother and Charlotte got out. Are they? We've stabilized them, but they need medical assistance. Will they? Yes, I think they'll make it, darling, but we need to hurry. I'm coming. I'll be there with a medevac as soon as I can."
When the medevac landed to pick up Avery, Peyton helped hoist her onto the stretcher and load her aboard. Then she hopped into the helicopter as well and directed them to the labs. When they landed again, she raced to her brother. His prosthetic was badly burned. He must have used it as a shield. That could be replaced. But his good arm was taped to his body, and a large gash ran across his forehead. He and Charlotte were both unconscious. Charlotte had a bandage across her upper chest. Peyton stood aside as soldiers loaded both of them onto the medevac. She had lost her father that night. She was terrified that she was going to lose her brother, too. When the medevac slipped out of sight,
Lynn began walking away.
Come on, Peyton. We need to talk. Your brother's life depends on what we do next.
Chapter 133. Millen was sitting on a cot, opening an MRE, when the door to the lab unsealed. He stood quickly, ready to defend the Kenyan villagers, then relaxed when he realized who was entering. Phil.
It's over, Millen. A cure. Come on, get upstairs. We've got work to do.
Millen joined the line in the auditorium, rolled up his shirt sleeve, and got his injection. The room was as lively as the New York Stock Exchange in the days before electronic trading. Everyone was shouting questions about the mysterious cure. There seemed to be no answers. Millen returned to his desk in the EOC after his dose and studied the new SOPs. Dr. Stevens had written them hastily. Millen had to reread several passages twice. When he finished, he pulled on his headset.
Centennial Park Checkpoint, BioShield Ops. We need an updated vial and headcount.
Near the end of Millen's shift, an operator notified him that he had a call on a CDC landline. The voice on the other end of the line belonged to someone Millen had thought he might never hear again. Alim Kibbit. His tone was serious.
I've got news, Millen.
When Alim finished speaking, Millen simply said, I'll be there as soon as I can. Millen waited outside Phil's office door for him to finish his phone call, then stepped inside. The senior CDC employee didn't look up from his laptop.
What can I do for you, Millen?
I need a favor. A big one.
Millen didn't know who was called or what favors were traded, but he got word a few hours later that a deal had been made. In the BSL-4 lab, he found Halima and Tian, both watching TV.
Get your stuff together.
Halima raised her eyebrows, fearful.
You're going home.
They ran to him, and Millen hugged both of them.
I didn't know, Halima began.
When you agreed to come with me, I promised you I'd take you home when this was over. I honor my promises.
They flew to D.C. first, then to Ramstein Air Base in Germany. The plane was filled with personnel who weren't very chatty, which made Millen curious. About half the tight-lipped operatives disembarked at Ramstein, and were replaced by people boarding from the base and from Landstuhl Medical Center. From there, they flew through the night to Incirlik Air Base in Turkey, and a smaller plane took Millen and the villagers to Kenyatta National Airport. Alim and Damiria were waiting for them. They had brought presents for the two villagers, a soccer ball for the boy, and a beaded Maasai necklace for the girl. The two seemed overjoyed by the gifts, and by the fact that Alim and Damiria had been thinking about them while they were gone. Instinctively, Millen knew they would adopt the two children. The thought made him very happy. He believed the four of them would be a wonderful family, despite the tragedy that had brought them together. At the hospital, Millen walked the halls with Alim. The place was packed, a madhouse, but things were getting done. Alim was seeing to that. The Kenyan seemed to know everyone by name and what they were doing. This was Alim's passion. In Mandera, when he was recuperating, Alim had told Millen that his own hospital was on life support. Its decline had taken the wind out of the Kenyan sails. Now the man's energy was back. In a way, the pandemic that had almost taken his life had actually restored his purpose and vitality. Millen thought it was a strange twist of fate, but he couldn't be happier for the man. Alim slowed as they approached the hospital room where Hannah lay. Her strawberry blonde hair spilled over the pillow. The machines by her bedside had been turned off. Millen stepped into the room. Behind him, he heard Alim pace away, already giving more orders. He reached out, took the white sheet and pulled it up, covering more of Hannah's body, then sat in the chair by the window. He was asleep within minutes. Millen awoke to the sound of sheets rustling. He looked toward the bed with bloodshot eyes.
Millen!
Hannah was sitting up, gazing in amazement at him.
Hi. Hi yourself. How did you get here?
I was in the neighborhood.
Seriously?
I told the CDC we had left somebody behind, close to where it all started. His response drained some of the excitement from her.
Oh.
And we never finished our book. She raised her eyebrows.
You know how I am about my TBR list.
She laughed. You don't have a TBR list.
True, I have a to-be-listened-to list. So I guess a TBLT list. He feigned being deep in thought. Just doesn't have the same ring to it.
No, it doesn't.
Anyway, he held up the cell phone with the Audible app. Shall we?
We shall.
She scooted over in the bed, making room for him.
I believe you know the drill.
As he had done before, he lay beside Hannah, plugged one earbud in one of his ears and the other in one of hers, and wrapped an arm around her. The last time he had clicked play, the pandemic was still a brush fire in a remote corner of the world. The two of them had been only a couple of weeks younger, but it felt almost like a lifetime ago. Millen had grown up a lot in that short amount of time. He had taken risks, handled new responsibilities, and learned what was really important. He wasn't going to let her out of his sight, not for a while.
You know, he said in a mock boastful tone, I actually oversaw the first ever patient recovery from X-1 Mandera.
Anna turned to him.
Oh, really?
Really? That patient turned out quite well. He saved you, after all.
Uh-huh,
Hannah said. She could obviously tell he was working up to something. I could extend those same services to you.
Oh, you could?
I could. In a serious tone, he added,
Would you like that? Do you want me to stay? More than anything.
Chapter 134. The sun was rising over the island by the time Lynn and Peyton reached the burned remains of the administrative building. The Sishium search teams had brought out their fallen comrades and laid them out in a row, in body bags with clear openings at the face. Peyton and Lynn marched down the row, peering at the windows into the body bags. Near the end of the row, Peyton saw her father's face. They had closed his eyes. Lynn Shaw knelt, unzipped the bag, and touched her husband's cheek. Peyton couldn't remember ever seeing her mother cry, but in that tropical island forest, with the first rays of sunrise beaming through the tree canopy, Lynn Shaw sobbed. Peyton realized it then. In some way, her mother had always expected her father to return. Lynn Shaw had had one great love in her life, and she had never given up hope of being reunited with him. Peyton understood that. Desmond was the only man she had ever truly fallen in love with. For the first time, she realized that she had always been waiting for Desmond to return. That's why she had never moved on with her life romantically, just like her mother had never dated after her father was taken from them. With her hands still on William's face, Lynn said,
A long time ago, we bought burial plots in London. I'd like to bury him there, and I'd like for you, your sister, and your brother to be there.
Peyton nodded. She found it fitting. She knew now that her parents hadn't fallen in love in London. That had occurred on the Beagle, but they had become a family in London. It was also where her father had been adopted, taken in, and helped to become the person he was. Lynn zipped up the body bag, composed herself, and turned to Peyton.
This crisis will soon be over. When that occurs, anger will replace fear. People won't be focused on how to survive. They'll want someone to blame, criminals to hang.
Peyton instantly realized what her mother was telling her. Andrew was in danger. Peyton felt conflicting emotions. Her brother had created the pathogen that had killed millions, but he had been brainwashed to do it.
I know what you're thinking, her mother said. You should know this. Yuri Pachenko's a survivor. He was a young boy in Stalingrad when the Germans came. He survived by the strength of his mind. When everyone was dying around him, he learned how to manipulate people to his will. Every person has a breaking point, weaknesses, levers that can be turned.
What was Andrew's?
Yuri threatened you.
Peyton exhaled.
And yours?
Andrew.
And you.
And Madison.
Lynn paused.
If we give Andrew to the world, they will try him and kill him, or imprison him. He isn't completely innocent, but he's not entirely guilty either. When he realizes what he's done, that weight will be a punishment more cruel than any the world could put upon him. What he needs now is to find his way back, to learn to live and love again.
Charlotte, Peyton thought. Lynn detailed her proposal to Peyton, then looked her daughter in the eye, waiting for her response. Peyton nodded.
All right, I'll do it.
They rose and began walking away from the bodies. Lynn spoke quietly.
There's something else. A month ago, someone located the Beagle. I don't know how. I can only assume the location was somewhere in the most classified Sishim files. Perhaps Desmond found it and told Avery. Or maybe she found it herself.
How do you know?
Rubicon sent a U.S. Coast Guard icebreaker, the Healy, to find it. Connor sank the ship. I still don't know where it is. I need you to ask Avery for the location.
Why?
Because of what's on it.
Which is?
A conversation for another time, Peyton. They walked in silence again, Peyton deep in thought. Like a compass returning to true north, her mind always drifted back to Desmond. She feared the answer to her next question, but she had to know.
Desmond's not here, is he?
As I said, Yuri's a survivor. He wouldn't set foot on this island without an escape plan, and he wouldn't leave without Desmond and Connor. They possess Rendition and Rook, both of which he needs.
What will they do to Desmond?
They'll try to help him regain his memories.
The thought terrified Peyton.
I'm going after him.
Lynn turned to her daughter.
There are greater forces at work here.
Not for me, there's not. You want the coordinates of the Beagle? I want Desmond back. You're going to help me, and you're going to tell me exactly what's going on.
Her mother smiled. Now that's the young lady I raised.
Chapter 135. When Desmond woke up, Connor was sitting on the bunk across from him. He knew instantly that he was on a ship. A submarine, he would have guessed. Connor cocked his head but didn't speak. Desmond's arm and leg hair were singed. Minor burns dotted his body, but he was okay. He looked his brother in the eyes.
You pulled me out, didn't you?
I did what you wouldn't do for me. I tried, Connor. I was 5. I was 3 months.
Desmond sat silently, hoping some of the anger would drain away.
Where are we going?
Connor smiled. The hideous scars contorted on his face.
We are going to finish this. You're going to help us.
He stood and walked to the hatch.
Get some rest. You'll need it.
In the passageway, Yuri was waiting.
Don't worry. We'll reach him. 13 years ago, I helped him rehabilitate you. You had lost your way just as he has lost his. Together, we'll save him. And we'll complete the looking glass.
Chapter 136. Peyton was sitting in Avery's tiny hospital room when she awoke. She rose and walked to the bed.
Hi. Hi.
For the first time since the two women had met, there wasn't an undercurrent of tension in their voices. Peyton still felt like clearing the air.
Listen, I know you and I haven't always seen eye to eye. I applaud your skill at understatement.
Peyton laughed.
Thank you.
She sat on the edge of the bed.
I guess what I'm trying to say is that I want to start over.
Avery nodded, but said nothing.
How are you feeling?
Avery glanced at the ceiling and opened her mouth, but quickly shut it, biting off a snide remark, Peyton thought. Maybe they really were starting over. Without making eye contact, she mumbled,
I'm okay.
A pause, and she stared at Peyton.
Desmond?
We're searching the island. Haven't found him yet.
You won't,
Avery said flatly. We're working on the assumption that Yuri and Connor escaped with him in custody.
They're going to go after them?
Yes. My mother knows the Sishim and Yuri better than anyone alive. She's going to help me. And I'd like your help. No, I want...
You want us to be partners?
I think there's no two people in this world who will work harder to find him.
You got that right.
So what's it going to be, Avery?
Yeah. Count me in, Doc.
Peyton smiled. Call me Peyton. There's one more thing. I need you to make a call for me.
What kind of call?
An important one. We need the coordinates of the Beagle's wreckage. 10 minutes later, Peyton opened the hatch to her mother's stateroom. Lynn Shaw looked up from her notebook.
Did you get it?
Peyton placed the scrap of paper on the desk. Lynn studied the handwritten GPS coordinates as if they were an ancient treasure, thought lost forever.
You've been looking for it for a very long time, Peyton said.
Yes.
Why?
Her mother exhaled. Peyton knew the reaction well. She was digging in.
Mom?
Lynn still said nothing.
We made a deal.
Very well. If you want to know, I'll have to show you.
Day 20. Final death toll. 31 million. Chapter 137. On the deck of the U.S. Coast Guard icebreaker, Peyton breathed in the cool morning air. She heard footsteps behind her and turned to find her mother approaching.
It's time.
Minutes later, they were in a submersible with two research assistants drifting toward the bottom of the Arctic Ocean. The four of them donned protective suits, docked with the wreckage of the Beagle, and disembarked. The dark, frigid tomb gave Peyton the creeps. There was so much history here. This was where her parents had met and fallen in love, and according to her father's account, where her brother had been conceived. The LED lamps on their helmets cut through the dark vessel, revealing it in swaths. Frozen dead bodies lay on the deck. Others had died in their bunks, a book by their side, covers pulled over them. In the labs, they found some more recently deceased bodies, members of the Rubicon team that had found the Beagle. They had starved. Connor had sunk the Healy, stranding the team here to preserve Sishim's secrets. Peyton wanted to know what was so valuable that it was worth taking the lives of these brave souls. Rows of doors lined the wall of the lab. They reminded Peyton of cold chambers in a morgue, except these doors each had a small peephole that could be uncovered. Peyton's mother moved to a safe on the wall and turned the dial.
It clicked open, and she withdrew a set of keys.
She turned to the two research assistants who had brought with them several airtight containers.
When I place the specimens inside, seal them quickly.
They acknowledged her orders, and Lynn moved to the closest door, opened it, and slid the drawer out, revealing a set of bones. They were human. No, the skull was different, and so was the pelvis. Lynn gently took hold of the skull and placed it in the first container. To the two team members, she said, "Quickly now." When the drawer was empty, Lynn closed it and used the key to open another. More bones. Human, but not that of a Homo sapiens sapiens, a prehistoric ancestor, forgotten until now. The team Lynn had brought with her made trip after trip, returning with empty containers, filling them, then leaving to return the specimens to the ship waiting at the surface. Peyton watched in amazement as the chambers were emptied. She counted 5 different human species in total. The other chambers held other animal species, a large feline, a seal, a porpoise, and many more. Peyton activated her comm.
Mom, what is this?
Let's speak when we are done. We have to preserve the samples.
When the last cold chamber was empty, Lynn told the research assistants to wait at the submersible. Then she gestured for Peyton to follow. They snaked through the dark passageways to a series of cramped offices. Lynn pulled open a drawer and rifled through the files. She opened one that was scribbled with German handwriting, then began to read the pages to herself.
Mom?
Lynn looked up, as if she had forgotten her daughter was still there. She seemed almost possessed.
Whose research is this? Peyton asked.
Lynn said nothing.
It's yours, isn't it? You collected those bones. Why?
Lynn took the folders out of the drawer and piled them on the desk. Finally, she faced Peyton.
Switch to channel 7.
When they were alone on the comm channel, Lynn spoke again.
Our Sishim cell was the original. Committed to the core belief. The founding question, we called it.
What question?
The question every sentient mind asks itself at one point or another. Why do I exist?
The answer's here on the Beagle?
Yes and no. We named the sub the Beagle in honor of another famous ship of the same name.
The ship that carried Charles Darwin around the world when he formed his early beliefs, what became the theory of evolution.
That's right. We believed that Darwin's theory was only half of the true picture of the nature of humanity, that the full truth was even more shocking.
And you found evidence of your theory?
Yes. We called our work the Extinction Files. We believe that by studying the genomes of extinct and living species, we could finally unravel the greatest secrets of the human race. What we found was... it was something none of us would ever have imagined.
Lynn paused, as if considering what to say next.
But we needed more data to confirm our theory.
More data, Peyton thought. In the cordons, they took DNA samples from every patient.
I was only told that the data would be collected, not how. Nevertheless, right now, somewhere in a Sitium lab, those billions of genetic samples are being sequenced. If we can obtain that data and combine it with the samples down here, we'll finally know the truth.
What are you telling me, Mom?
There's a code buried in the human genome, and if our theory is correct, what it leads to will change our very understanding of human existence.
Epilogue. In the days after the X1 Mandera pandemic ended, the South Australia Relief Alliance, or SARA, was inundated with refugees seeking help. Luckily, they had a new staff member. Andrew was thankful for the work. It kept him from thinking about what had happened and what he had done. He would never forgive himself, no matter how many patients he treated, how many lives he saved. For the rest of his life, he would carry a debt that could never be repaid. Charlotte had tried to get him to move on, but he couldn't. She insisted that time heals all wounds. He wasn't sure he believed that, but he wanted to. He stepped into a patient room and closed the door. His prosthetic arm held a simple attachment, his other hand a clipboard with the patient's name. His own name had been something of a dilemma. Andrew Shaw was technically dead, and if anyone ever came looking, he didn't want to be found. In that sense, the remote outback aid camp was the perfect place for him. All there was to do here was work and spend time with Charlotte. They had a lifetime to catch up on. "Hi," he said. "My name's William Moore. I'm the attending physician today. How are you feeling?" Avery sat in the conference room in the low-rise building in Research Triangle Park, the same room where she had interviewed with Rubicon Ventures so many years before. The same man who had interviewed her back then, David Ward, sat across from her. "I'm proud of you," he said.
"I'm proud of me too."
"Seriously, Avery, listen for a second. What you did was beyond the call of duty. There's no award this nation confers that even begins to recognize the type of risk you took or the skill you displayed. What I'm trying to tell you is, I know what you did, and everyone up the Rubicon chain of command knows, and we appreciate you."
Avery fidgeted in her seat, unsure what to say. After a moment, she asked what she'd come here to ask.
"My father?"
David nodded. "Was very well taken care of. We had him transferred to the Dean Dome. He's still there. I'll call and let them know you're coming."
"Thanks."
David leaned back in his chair.
"Can we trust them?"
Avery knew he was talking about Peyton and Lynn Shaw. What she didn't know was what to say.
"Time will tell."
"It would be nice to know ahead of time."
"I don't see what option we have." David let the chair ease forward.
"Lots of people are unhappy about Lynn Shaw's immunity agreement."
"I don't blame them. But they'll have to get over it. We need her."
"You're sure?"
"This isn't over. We don't know what's next. It could be worse than the pandemic. We need to start dismantling the Sitium. We need somebody who's been on the inside to do that. We can sort everything else out once we've finished this."
"All right, I can live with that."
Avery stood, and David walked her out. At the door, his tone softened.
"Don't worry, okay?"
"About what?"
"You know what, Avery. We're going to do everything we can to find him. Every resource we have is at your disposal. I know what Desmond means to you."
At the Dean Dome, Avery weaved through the rows of makeshift cubicles. She had waited until she was well enough to pretend she wasn't in any pain. She didn't want her father to know, just in case he recognized her. At his cubicle, she waited at the opening for him to see her. His reaction to her always told her what sort of day he was having. The Alzheimer's had progressed a lot in the last few years. Good days were becoming more and more rare.
"Can I help you?"
he asked.
"No," she said quietly. "I was just coming by to visit, see if you needed anything."
He glanced around.
"No, think I'm all set." He scrutinized her face. "You look..."
"Do I know you?"
She walked into the cubicle, scanned it, and found what she was looking for. She pulled out the folding metal chair, sat at the small table, and moved the deck of cards to the middle. How about a game of gin rummy? He raised his eyebrows as he sat across from her.
Sure, why not? It's my favorite game, actually.
After the second game, he asked,
So what did you do during the pandemic?
Oh, nothing important. Peyton sat in the car outside the stately home waiting for the line to connect. Millen Thomas was laughing when he answered.
Yeah, hello?
He was distracted and amused by something. Millen, it's Peyton Shaw. She could hear him walking away, exiting a room where people were talking.
Dr. Shaw, how are you?
Just fine, Millen. Listen, I'm short on time, so I'll get right to it. I'm putting together a team for a new type of investigation. It's not CDC. It's a cross-sectional group. Are you interested?
Maybe. I don't know. What kind of investigation?
A scientific one, with far-reaching implications. Peyton waited, but Millen made no response. It involves animals.
What kind of animals?
He asked slowly. Extinct ones. Peyton could hear a pin drop. Millen, are you there?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm definitely here. When would you need me?
Tomorrow. Silence again. He exhaled deeply.
Look, I'd like to, but there's someone I need to take care of.
Peyton smiled. I understand, Millen. It's a good choice. A really good choice. Tell Hannah I said hi. Peyton got out of the car and walked up to the house. When Elliot opened the door, he didn't say a word. He merely stepped outside and hugged her. 15 minutes later, she sat at the dinner table with Elliot, Rose, Ryan, Sam, and Adam. Elliot looked at each one of them, then said,
Well, I thought since Thanksgiving got just a little interrupted, a do-over was in order.
He looked Peyton in the eyes, one with all of our family. If this year has shown us anything, it's how much we have to be thankful for.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Pandemic, The Extinction Files, Book 1. Written by A.G. Riddle, performed by Eduardo Ballerini. Executive producers, Steve Feldberg and Mike Charzik. Producer, Neil Basic. Copyright, 2017 by A.G. Riddle. Production copyright, 2017 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.